Good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, June the 28th, 2016, 1:12 coming up on 1:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have an interesting story here to chronicle today. After more than half a century, Grove City College was taken off the top of the American Association of University Professors censor list at its 102nd annual meeting earlier this month. A gentleman who had something to do with this, who has led a very interesting life, is our guest today. He is retired Professor Emeritus, 94-year-old Larry Guerra. Larry, how are you?
I'm fine.
Larry, I want to start out here and kind of get the backstory on this. First of all, when you heard that the censor was going to be lifted after 53 years, what were your thoughts?
Well, I was very pleased because when I was fired in 1962, I called on the AUP to evaluate my teaching because they used a fake charge of bad teaching. So I called on the AUP to evaluate my teaching, which they did, and the report was so good that it enabled me, barely, but it did enable me to get another job. Now, I didn't have anything to do with the censure. That was the AUP's way of doing things.
Now, what is a censure at a college?
Well, it is a warning that the college is not practicing the usual professional standards with their faculty. For instance, they may not have a hearing if a person is accused of something. And of course, Grove City College gave me no opportunity to oppose the charges they made. They made ridiculous charges. The president was really a strange person. He even said that my wife put wash on the line Sundays to irritate the Presbyterians. First of all, she never washed on Sunday, and secondly, she had no interest in irritating Presbyterians. But there were all kinds of charges. One of the things they didn't like about me was that I was a vegetarian. Well, that was none of their business.
When you heard the censor had been lifted, how did that make you feel, being that you were part of this back 53 years ago?
Well, I felt very good, but it had all been preceded by a visit to my home here in Wilmington by a former college president of Grove City, Richard Jewell, and he called me out of the blue and said, would I be willing to talk with him? Didn't say any more than that. And I said, sure, why not? And he came, and he was very cordial, very interesting. We had a lot in common, actually. And we had a long conversation. We had lunch together. My wife prepared a lunch. And when he left, he said he was going to report his meeting with me. And I said, and write me a letter telling about it. And I said, well, what can I do with that letter? He said, anything you want. So, of course, when the letter came, I gave it to our press release person here at the college, and he was excited. He gave it to the AP, and 90 colleges all over the world published that story. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
What was the tenor of that meeting when he came over?
Very friendly. Very friendly. He did not use the word apology, I think because he was ordered not to, but he said regrets several times. And in the letter he wrote me, he said, I really regret that this happened because you were not in the wrong. So it was very friendly. And he's going to visit me again this summer, I think, just for friendship.
You were fired from Grove City in 1962. The censor is not lifted until 2016. That is 53 years. Why do you think it took so long?
Well, I don't think they ever were thinking of it. I think they've sort of put it back of their agenda until one of their alums, Steve Toffee, wrote an article about the college. He was started out trying to remove the censor, actually, and said that Grove City had been done wrong. And the more research he did, the more he was convinced that, no, they did wrong to me. And he, when he published his letter, article, he gave a copy to the president of Grove City, who was then Jewell. Jewell's retired. He gave it to him, and Jewell was sort of shocked by it and did his own research and said, he was absolutely right. The AUP was had unearthed things that were really not acceptable in a working college. They even sent detectives around for a week to try to find something on me. There was nothing to find. In fact, one of them said they ought to call off the investigation because there isn't anything. He's a very dull guy. He doesn't have anything. He didn't have any political problems or anything. And so that started the ball rolling. Steve Toffee's article got Richard Jewell to do his own research and then later decide that the college had to somehow express to me regret.
1962, you were working there. Take me through what happened that caused all this investigation and eventually caused the censor.
Well, I am a pacifist and I'm an activist, but I was not an activist at Grove City. And I did do this. I did write a letter to the college paper warning about the dangers of nuclear war and, saying we ought to try to get better relations with the Soviet Union. A student there had written a letter saying that we ought to really crack down on the Soviets. And I said, this might mean nuclear war and that would mean extermination of everything. We can't risk that. That's all I did. And that letter apparently got the attention of the spy that was there. There was a spy for the very, very conservative board member. He was head of the board, J. Howard Pugh. J. Howard Pugh was the chairman of the board, and the person in the college who was his spy was a guy named Hans Stenholz, who was actually a veteran of the German Army in World War II. But I don't hold that against him. He's just a kid, you know. I mean, I never had an argument with him or anything, but he spied on us, and he reported two people to the AUP. He reported them, to the president. He reported them because the chairman, that was the guy who reported me, wanted his economics program to substitute for our history program. And two of us opposed that. We were not even friends, but we both did later contact the AUP. But anyway, there were several things like that. For instance, the president had the chair of the Republican Party called me and say I should vote Republican, and I said I wouldn't vote, and that was a bad thing. He reported me for that, but I couldn't vote. I was still on parole. And they knew that. They knew everything about me. When I was hired there, President Professor William Heseltine of the University of Wisconsin, my professor. I was very close to him, and he wrote a letter to them telling all the problems I might have, but saying I do not want him to get into trouble. Why he hired me, I don't know. It was a mistake. Well, I do know. I didn't want to go there. He called me. That is, the president of the college called me out of the blue the summer of 1962. I already was under contract with Eureka College, and I didn't want to move, but he argued me for a whole hour until I agreed to go to visit the school. Then he argued again until I accepted the job. So I didn't choose them. They chose me.
Well, that being said, that the president had hired you and that he was a bit of a strange man, but he did report you for these things and he did do these investigations that didn't have any return to him. What did he fire you for? When you were called into the office that day, did you think you were going to be let go? How did that all go down?
Well, he wasn't there, of course. It was the dean and another person from the administration. They told me that my teaching was so bad that parents were complaining and that I could not stay on there. They put it solely on the matter of teaching.
And this all dated...
And I said, well, that I never was told that. And they said, well, we got letters and so forth. I said, could I see some? They said yes, but they never showed me any. And I'm sure there were some complaints. There always are. On the other hand, one parent of a current student there at the time came to the house complaining about his daughter's grade. And I showed him her paper, and he said, oh, that got exactly the grade it deserved. So, I mean, he calmed down, you know. Maybe some of the others didn't, and I don't know how many there were. He said there were lots and lots, but I'm not sure about that. He never told me, never showed me any more.
You know, Larry, people think today that colleges are very liberal places. That's the Bernie Sanders crowd. That's the socialist crowd. It's interesting that you were fired for being too pacifist, too liberal back in those days. Were colleges a lot more conservative then?
Well, Grove City was. Certain colleges are conservative, and they have a right to be. I would never deal with them or go with them, you know. But I only went there because Parker talked me into it. And the department was okay. Not all the faculty members were conservative. But in fact, when I was fired, six of them resigned in protest. But basically, Grove City and Hillsdale and Fall Wells College, they're all conservative. And that's okay. That's what they want to be. They have a right to be, you know, if they want to be a conservative institution. The others, I don't think, are deliberately liberal, but most people who are well-educated, really well-educated, tend to be not extremely conservative, you know, the right-wing type, the Ku Klux Klan type. They're not like that. And they weren't like that at Grove City. In fact, some of the other faculty members were friendly and but they had other reasons for being there. It was a hard time to be a college teacher. And I had gone to Eureka College, which is a little college in Illinois, and I met Reagan twice. It was his alma mater. They weren't conservative, though, and he never said any interfered with the workings of the college, even though he was on the board.
What were your thoughts on Ronald Reagan? He's become this mythical character now in the conservative movement.
Well, he's not the character they say he is. I mean, he did some fairly liberal things. Under him, some rather liberal legislation passed, and he agreed with it. But he did have these outrageous... You know, he had been a Democrat. And he had these outrageous things to say about poor people and the, you know, people who are on welfare and that sort of thing. But he was a very pleasant person. He was extremely you might say, an extreme people person. And, of course, that's how he got along in politics. Although I think his problems, physical problems, mental problems, really, start earlier than we realize. I was never a Reagan fan, but I didn't, I wasn't, you know, I'm not one to hate people or anything. He didn't mess around with the college, and I thought that was good. But he did pass some fairly liberal legislation, or at least he signed it when they passed it.
That being said, Larry, why do you believe in the 20th century, and now well into the 21st century, he is this mythical figure? If you don't pay homage to Ronald Reagan in the Republican Party, you don't go very far. And his funeral in 2004, people lined the streets. It was a national event.
Oh, yeah. Well, it always is when a president dies. Well, of course, if you're a Republican and you want some former president to praise, look at him. You got Harding, you got Nixon, who really messed up, and none of them were really very popular when it came right down to it, except Reagan.
What about Eisenhower?
And, Reagan, of course, recovered from being shot, and he almost died as a result of that, and of course, endeared him. I mean, his recovery and what he said. He made these speeches, which were pretty right wing, and they liked it. But the basic, I mean, I have a lot of Republican friends. I'm not a Republican. I tend to be a socialist myself. You know, I was raised in a socialist town, Reading, Pennsylvania.
Well, Larry, I want to get back to this idea for Reagan just for a second here, because they do have Eisenhower, and he is a war hero. Why don't they ever look back to Eisenhower?
He wasn't conservative enough, I don't think. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea why they do what they do.
Well,
any politician.
Well, that being said. Well, that being said, in regard to Reagan, yes, other presidents do die, and I remember Truman's funeral and LBJ,
right.
and Gerald Ford, but nothing like Reagan. When Reagan died, people did line the street. It was a bigger event than.
Oh, he was very popular, no question about it. Extremely popular.
How does a Republican in the United States of America in 1984 win 49 states?
How does the Republican win how did that happen?
How did it happen? When Reagan ran against Mondale, he won every state.
Oh, I see. You're talking about the Reagan.
Yeah.
I don't know.
How did a Republican win California and New York?
I don't know that. Well, of course, he had been on the board of the university, and I guess he was president of one of California universities, and cracked down on the dissent there. And in fact, I found out I had a good friend who was a friend of Reagan's when he was in college. He became a very good friend. He told me a lot about him, and he said he led a student rebellion when he was in college. And even the president was replaced. They had another president in the college.
Well,
of course, that was when he was a Democrat, but the same guy.
Well, it's interesting because we've done a lot on Reagan on this show and had a lot of his biographers on, Edmund Morris, and I believe David Brinkley was on here a while ago. And what they all say is that if you went into Reagan's office and said you didn't have any money, he would give you the shirt off his back. But then he would sit down shirtless, and he would deny a bill for welfare.
Right. That's true. I personally, he was a very nice guy.
It's very nice.
But he got that ideology, which was extreme, didn't always interfere with everything he did politically, but it did. It was part of his stick, so to speak.
Larry, you say Grove City in 1962 was a conservative college. You say colleges have the right to be conservative or liberal. Did they have the right to fire you, basically because they felt you were too liberal once you got there?
No. In fact, I'm sure that the chairman of the board who ordered it didn't know that when he was hired. When I was hired, I think the president kept that from him. But they did not have a right to fire me because they knew everything about me. And I had done nothing wrong. That's what Richard Jewell said. You had done nothing wrong.
When we look back at your life, Larry, because for people who don't know you, it's a very fascinating life. You were are you still a Quaker?
Yes, I am.
For people who don't know what a Quaker is, what's the definition of that?
Well, it's a Society of Friends. It's a religion which emphasizes peace and that of God in every man or every woman.
Now,
there are many variations of Quakerism. And we have a small quiet meeting, but there's no minister, but people speak if they're moved to do that. They're very active on social issues. There are many Quakers. There are different Quakers. There are some very conservative, evangelical Quakers. But there are the original Quakers had no minister, and the meeting I joined had no minister. And it was a mixed meeting. There were a mix of people there in it, and they were all friendly. It was just they were very friendly people. And they have done a lot of international service projects. And they had work camps. And during World War II, they provided work camps for some objectors. I wouldn't accept that, but they did have it, and that was a plus. They are not. They don't dress up differently today. They don't all use thee and thou different as they used to. And of course, they've adjusted to the times. Many of the Quakers went to war.
Well, that being said, I would say that your life of activism took a big turn in World War II. You refused to register for the draft,
right?
And were for World War II and were imprisoned for 3 years for this. Take me back. Why wouldn't you just register for the draft, and what happened after that?
Well, I wouldn't register because I wanted to make the maximum protest against war. Not that particular war, but the institution of war. And I knew what had happened in World War I when people did that. They were jailed. And they were tortured, actually. We were not tortured, by no means. But I just felt I had to do it. And then when I read about the eight students at Union Theological Seminary who did the same thing for the same reason and went to prison, it confirmed me. There was nothing else I could do and maintain my self-respect. I felt that strong about it. I never carried a draft card, never had one. They kept sending them to me, and I kept sending them back. But that was the first time that there was an effort to prevent me from going into the profession I was hoping to go into. There were three times. The second time was the counseling case at Bluffton, and the third was being fired at Grove City. They really wanted me out. They followed me here. They had people writing to the college here, but the president stood firm.
Why was this? I want to give people the background who don't know. You did refuse to register for the draft in World War II. You were imprisoned for 3 years, and then in 1948, carrying over into 49, you were accused of counseling a student not to register for the draft. Prison time arose from that, and then we have heard about the Grove City case. Just a little background. What happened in 48 and 49? Did you counsel a student not to register for the draft?
Of course not. That would have been totally unprofessional and wrong. I did not know that student when he refused. When he was arrested, I was there. I was in charge of a dorm, and he lived there. And I was with him when he was arrested. When he was arrested, I called. I said, "Don't let them coerce you into changing your conscience." And they said, "That's counseling." Well, I didn't think it was counseling. I didn't intend it as such. It was just a friendly goodbye. But I had never, ever... in fact, I told him in conversation before that, when I saw him on the campus, I said, "Now, because I refuse, don't think you have to stay with your refusal. It's tough, it's difficult, and you may not want to do it. But if so, change your position." In fact, I counsel him to that. He should do what his conscience tells him, but I don't think he should use my case as any example at all. The FBI was out to get me. They really were. It was a rigged trial all the way. We took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, where we lost 4-4.
And what did you lose on the basis of?
We were trying to overturn the conviction. The conviction stood.
Trying to clear this up for the audience. So it's illegal to counsel somebody not to register for the draft?
That is correct. However, they couldn't do that to me today what they did in 48, because there's another case in the Supreme Court which indicates that when a person refuses to register, that is a crime. It is not a continuing offense. So if the person who counseled him, if it's more than 5 years, they couldn't prosecute. So they couldn't prosecute me they could do it only within 5 years.
Why is it that freedom of speech did not trump that? Because you weren't saying don't register for the draft. He was already in trouble. When it got to the Supreme Court, it was really out of the college state hands at that point. How did the most powerful and really becoming sort of a lawmaking body in this country in this day and age look at that and find you guilty?
Well, that's exactly what my lawyer said. I went through the appeal court, there was a very liberal woman on the court at that time in the Sixth Circuit of Appeals, and she and all the others voted against me. I think it was the hysteria of the Cold War. The only reason that it was a 4-4 decision was because the Attorney General, who had prosecuted my case, Tom Clark, was on the court, and he couldn't vote on that. So they didn't even discuss the case. They just said no. And all the Supreme Court cases are now in book form, and I have the book, which shows the whole arguments on all sides.
Now
they wouldn't even let the boy who refused to register testify. They wouldn't let his father testify. They wouldn't let a man who claimed that he had counseled him testify. The only one who could testify was my wife, and that was it.
That's interesting. And just to play devil's advocate on the other side, I mean, when you look back at it, even though you didn't intend for it to be counseling, wasn't that advice when you say, "Don't let them change what you believe"? I mean, you might not have meant it that way, but isn't that advice in its form?
Well, you could look upon it as that. I was sort of very nervous at the time and maybe shouldn't have said anything. Just goodbye. I guess you can look on it that way, yes.
So that's a very interesting case, and if you had just said goodbye or stick to your convictions, you know, it's Language is a very interesting thing, much more important than I think people give it credit.
Well, there was another, if you're going into depth here, there was another factor. I had said I would advise non-registration, but I never did it.
Do you think by getting up, well, let me put it this way, when you were teaching at that point in 1948-1949, this is after World War II, you'd already had the incident where you were in prison for 3 years for not registering to the draft, you were a pacifist, an activist. Did that bleed into your teaching? Did you talk about your personal experiences?
No, not in class. Never did. Not even at Grove City. I didn't even talk about the trouble I was in. I'm very professional. Very professional. This is, to me, very important.
When you go into a classroom and teach, when you went into a classroom all your years, did anything ever bleed in? Did students ask you questions? Not purposely, but did your experience in life and where you came from, your religion, did it ever subconsciously, you think, bleed into what you were doing?
It might have. I mean, everybody on the campus here knew that I was a peace activist and active at it. In fact, they encouraged it. This is a Quaker college. So the president encouraged it. He encouraged me to be in peace vigils.
Why do you think they were out to get you? You said they were out to get you. You did spend 6 years in prison in your life. Why were they out to get you and stop you? What could one person...
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, what could one person in Ohio do?
Yeah. It's just unbelievable, really. Of course, Bluffton is also a pacifist school. That's a Mennonite school. And the president stuck with me and argued with the DA after I was convicted and kept arguing, wrote more than a dozen letters to him saying, this is wrong, he didn't do this, and he did not break the law. And Prexy was wonderful. I was only there in a one-year appointment, but he thought it was an outrage. The next morning after I was arrested, he called the faculty of the school together and said, this is an outrage and I'm going to try to correct it.
When you look back at either of those times you were imprisoned, do you wish you hadn't have done it, maybe handled it a different way and not spend any time in prison?
Well, I wish I hadn't spent any time in prison, but I couldn't. You know, some non-registrants were not prosecuted. I couldn't register. That was just, I don't think I could today. That's so important to me that to be part of the war system, which registration means. I mean, even though they recognize COs, but they're still within the system. No, I couldn't do that.
Now, how long did your felonies last?
Well, the first one, I served every day of 3 years. The second one, I chose not to start the sentence until the court had ruled, and the court was going to take a long time, and I finally did start the sentence, so I served 7 months on the second. They were so glad to get rid of me. Complaints and people writing and phoning and bothering the Justice Department. They were so glad to get rid of me. In fact, they were glad to get rid of all the COs. They were just trouble.
Now, Larry, while I have you here, I do want to spend the last few minutes here talking about, because you have been an activist all your life, you're 94, still active there in Wilmington. You are in our state, and of course, as you know and everybody knows, our state is a swing state in the big upcoming presidential election, unlike any I think anybody has seen before. What do you make of Donald Trump?
Well, I think he's extremely dangerous. Just look at the things he said. I mean, now he's trying to tone it down all. But he ridiculed a handicapped person. He was obnoxious and pornographic about a woman reporter. He thinks anybody who doesn't agree with him is vicious. I mean, you know, he's not there's something wrong with the guy. I mean, he's a businessman, but he hasn't been all that successful always. I mean, he's not very bright. He was in Scotland and praised the decision to leave the European Common Market, and the Scottish people hated. They didn't vote that way. He was in Scotland. He wasn't in England. So I don't. I'm scared of him. I really am.
All that being said, as you put it, not bright, dangerous, things about women, things about handicapped people, how does that person win the nomination of one of the two major political parties for the highest office in the land?
Well, he doesn't have the nomination yet, but he certainly won a lot of elections. I can't figure that one out. I mean, I just can't figure it out. Some of the hate groups, the worst hate groups in the country, are supporting him. And I know that there's a lot of discontent, the people who've been bummed around by the system, and they seem to think that if you get rid of the way things have been done politically, it'll improve, when actually there's no evidence at all that that will be the case. In fact, England itself is having problems now already. But there's an awful lot of hatred, and of course, Hillary has a lot of baggage too, but different. She's not dumb. I don't know. It's hard to explain.
I mean,
people in the other countries are just they're just astounded.
Well, that being said, we stand, what now, about 5 months out from the election. Is it theoretical? Is it possible that this man could be the next president of the United States?
They're saying that, but I don't think so. I think there'll be a terrific sweep when the chips are down. Sanders people will probably vote for Clinton, and I don't know. You know, nobody knows, not even Rachel Maddow. She tries to conjecture and think, but she doesn't know either.
The Republican convention will be held in our state, just up the road here in Cleveland, Ohio. Do you think there's going to be trouble there, being that it is a liberal city, it is the Republican convention, it is going to be a fairly contentious convention with Donald Trump accepting the nomination, it looks like?
Well, I think there will be trouble. I'm afraid there will. Look what happened the other day in California. And that wasn't even the election, but I think there's going to be trouble.
Let's talk about Hillary. What are your thoughts on Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think she's a very competent person. I think she's been maligned, and she's done some very stupid things, and her past political career doesn't bode for the good I would want, totally. Except it's so much better than having a deranged guy in there. I think she's trying to do well. I can't understand why anybody would accept $250,000 for a speech. The most I got was $700, and that was way more than I ever got.
Is it?
That was when I gave my speech here on the day that. I heard from Grove City College. It all happened in one day. I was to speak to a group of faculty members. They had an annual lecture. I thought about 20 people were there, but the news broke and there was a packed auditorium. And they were very nice. They were very nice to me. It's overwhelming, you know?
I can imagine.
I appreciate it, but it is overwhelming, and I hope this is the end of it.
At 94, Larry, you are an activist, as you say. What is an activist's life like at 94?
Well, the most I can do is write letters and go to silent vigils. I can't do a long walk, but we do keep up with things, and we do contribute financially to peace organizations. There are too many organizations for every cause, But we maintain activity, both Lenna and I. We've been married 70 years.
Do you still like...
I got married at Penn College, where I went after I got out of prison. It was a Quaker experiment in Pacifist College in Oscaloosa, Iowa, William Penn.
What do you make...
I was there a while, and we had a little group of Pacifist friends. One of them was Lena May, and we did some folk dancing. That's all we could have. One night, we went out for a drink of water, and she popped out at me without any warning, "Do radical pacifists ever get married?" I said, "Yeah, that's a good idea," and we were engaged.
Larry, what do you make
of... That's the way it was, and we're still in love.
70 years later.
Absolutely.
Larry, what do you make of the big gun debate in this country right now?
That is another one hard to explain. Public opinion obviously wants common sense gun legislation, and I know that all the legislation would not stop every event, but it certainly would help. And I don't understand why they would object to banning assault weapons to individuals when they had been banned before. It's beyond me. I mean, it's just one of the things and of course, the NRA has convinced so many people that if they have background checks that are really solid, then they won't be able to, nobody will be able to buy guns. That's ridiculous. They have a lot of power. Business groups of all kinds have a lot of power, and that's one that is obviously interested in selling more weapons. But it's hard to explain why they won't at least allow for a vote. They're afraid to be on the side of what they're voting for. It's crazy.
President Obama. Well, President Obama is about to end his term of 8 years in office. What do you make of how he's been treated? Where will he be regarded in the history of presidents?
Well, that's a good question. You never know that. But I think his problems show a lot of racism. When Trump says, "Make the country great again," and there's a big sign in Tennessee, a huge billboard sign saying, "Let's make the country white again." I mean, there's been a lot of hidden racism in this. I think he did very well on lots of things, on a few things I don't like. But, you know, no president, and people ought to realize this is going to be 100% with any individual. You just don't want them to mess up a lot and get into wars and, you know, try to minimize the danger of nuclear weapons, which apparently Trump wants to give more to more people. I don't think that makes any sense either. It's unprecedented. You know, as a historian, I don't know what's going to happen. I wouldn't dare predict the future.
Looking back, you've been around, Larry, since the 20s. Are times better now? Or were times better then? What was the greatest period in your life?
Well, I don't know. Of course, I can't say any greatest period. I think it's a lot better now. Life is better. I mean, there are more things that you can have, and more people own homes, and there's a lot of things have improved. Although the Depression hit real hard, and the war hit real hard. But I like the United States. I thought of leaving once when I was under fire, you know. But no, I lived a year in Mexico. I taught my first year of teaching was in Mexico City College, and I realized that I wanted to be back in the U.S. I'm an American, USA.
After this last year, with the apology coming from the college and the censor being lifted, this past month. Anything you still want to do? Anything left?
Yeah, I'm writing my autobiography. It's called My Last Carrot. Because when I had a sign telling about a coming demonstration, somebody wrote underneath, "Gara, while you are chomping your last carrot in front of a Soviet firing squad," and went on and on. I thought "the last carrot" is a nice name for an autobiography. Lena May has written hers, and it's beautiful. She's a much better writer than I am. But that's what it's called. I'm chapter 8 now, or 9.
Is there anything in that book that people would be shocked to know?
I hope not. No, I don't think so.
Have you ever done anything you wish you could take back?
Yes, I did. I would have been less belligerent in my early days, and I wouldn't have written some of the letters I wrote. Protest letters were too strong. They were not friendly, and they just would turn people off. But, you know, I had a little of that post-traumatic syndrome from my imprisonment, and I was pretty grumpy for a while.
What is the secret to living to be 94?
Well, there's a long secret. First of all, I'm a vegetarian. Secondly, I never drank. Third, I never smoked. And fourth, I have a loving family.
And that's how you do it.
That's how I did it. I don't know, you know. I'm not wise on that issue, but I do think those things contributed to where we are today, and Lena May agrees.
When you look back on this whole thing, when the time finally does come that you leave this life, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, the way I am, first of all, as a historian, a good historian, I work real hard at it, and as a person who tried to work for peace and social justice, I think it's very important that people do this. And even though things seem to go backwards sometimes, I think that those things do last. And that was one reason I refused to register. I wanted nonviolence to be kept alive when everybody else was doing the killing.
Larry, it's been a pleasure to speak with you today. It's always fascinating. We had you on last year when the AP story broke. We're glad to have you on, and hopefully we'll be able to call on you in the next few months as this presidential election heats up. It's a pleasure, and I'm so glad things are going well for you.
Thanks a lot. You too. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Professor Larry Gara of Wilmington, Ohio. What an interesting life. That wraps it up for us today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Stay tuned to much more here on WWGH Radio.
You know, Marvin, Mary, doesn't seem to like you very much.